Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting Frostbitten episode of the Michael and Patty Show, bringing to you over 41 years of real estate experience and thousands of transactions handled in less than 38 minutes. Well, we're going to aim for 35. How's Patty doing this morning?
I'm doing very well, and I like how you've upped the number by a year now.
I checked the calendar. Today in PEI, we're sitting on the Charlottetown waterfront as usual, and it's nothing but white. How would you? One big frozen mass.
Yes, you definitely need your sunglasses on today, not because the sun is out, but because of the glare from all the crisp white snow that is covering the horizon.
It's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Over the body of water. Like you can't even
see. The Hillsborough River.
Yeah, you can't see the water because it's completely covered with a blanket of ice and snow as well.
Super cool. Not that I would be walking across the river today unless you'd like to try that.
No.
You remember years ago, I think it happened in Summerside when someone was ice fishing and they were trying to bring in their ice fishing hut. So a guy backs up his pickup truck, goes through the ice, and then he calls a friend. So his pickup truck backs up to pull the first guy out, pull the ice hut out, and then he goes through the ice.
This does not sound like a smart endeavor at all.
It's just like people get stuck in farmers' fields in the spring. They send out one pickup truck. He sinks to the axles to send out a second. He sinks to the axles to call a farm tractor to pull both of them out.
Yeah.
Sort of idea.
I've experienced that for showings. But
have you?
Yes.
Topic number one. It's minus 10 out, as we said, which is part of this podcast's point. And we're going to discuss why you shouldn't pump your septic system. On our purchase and sale agreements in the Schedule A, there's a paragraph to pump and inspect the septic tank. And of course, all the agents feel they have to include this because it's on the Schedule A, so it wouldn't be there unless it was to be used. The challenge being from a homeowner's perspective is if you Google or you ChatGTP this, your tank may actually crack because what you're doing is you're removing all the liquids. Now the air is cooling the lid, assuming it's a plastic lid, and there's no insulation. So it's not really something you should be doing. One of the things I noticed in my research, which I thought was pretty cool, is if you do intend to do this, you can use bags of mulch, or they referred to straw insulating blankets to cover the lids so that they won't freeze. In the case that this is a concrete septic tank, I probably wouldn't pump it regardless because those are the ones that are usually more problematic. I haven't heard of the plastic one cracking yet. Have you?
No, there's a whole bunch of, so there's other components here to be considered as well. I mean, that I never really thought of, Michael, just even letting the cold air inside of it because they do run the risk of cracking. But if it's a seasonal property and no one's living there year round to start to fill the tank again with refuse, then you do run the risk 100% of it cracking because it should sit, if it's a seasonal property, no less than half full is what I have always been told by septic companies. If you are a seller and you're considering selling and you think perhaps, you know what, sometime in the next year, I am going to be putting my property on the market, you might want to go ahead and just get the septic tank pumped and inspected, get the septic company to put a little statement on saying that the septic tank is serviceable going forward. And then that'll circumvent any issues should you end up getting a sale and a closing during the winter months.
It's good advice. And I like the idea of putting mulch, bags of mulch on top to insulate it if they're plastic lids, which would be more predominant with the newer homes.
Yeah. And the other issue that you would end up coming towards, like heading, would be the septic lid itself could be under 4 feet of snow. Who is going to be cutting a path, clearing snow to go to the lid? And
I just ran into this just last week.
No.
Yes, we discounted a property by $30,000 or $40,000 below asking price, which was completely reasonable. But one of our conditions is if you want to inspect the tank in the middle of winter, you can remove the snow.
Yeah.
And they refused to do it.
Yeah, I wouldn't think anyone would want to.
So I went out there with a shovel and I cleared off the 16th of an inch of snow off those two lids, and I took pictures and sent it to them. But that's the other thing, is in that paragraph, it makes the vendor responsible for moving the snow. And Murphy's Law says they're not going to do it on the whole week that's 2 or 3 degrees and sunny. They're going to wait until there's a friggin' blizzard and you got 4 feet of snow. And they're going to say, oh, we decided to inspect the septic today.
Yeah, only because probably they just found out they got their finance approved and they're willing to bear the cost.
As they don't want to waste their $300. On to other things. When you sell a house, typically, do you have to fill up the oil tank, which fuels your boiler, your oil-fired boiler, typically, and your propane tank, which would fire your propane fireplace and possibly a propane range?
Typically is the word I'm pulling from your sentence and question. Typically, yes. It all goes back to what's in the contract, but there is a clause within our contract agreement under the fuel adjustment, and a seller is responsible if that is in the contract and hasn't been striked out or removed. They're responsible, whatever the fuel type is, if it's oil or propane, to fill up the tanks. And then at closing, again, all as per your contract, the buyer is responsible to purchase that full tank of propane or oil at whatever the cost per liter is on that day.
So what you would typically do, based on our contracts as they're typically written, is you would fill up the propane and the oil tank within a few days of closing. You provide those invoices to your lawyer. They would provide it to the purchaser's lawyer. It'd be put in the adjustments, and you would get reimbursed for that stuff. With propane tanks, they're rented unless they're stolen. So you would pay probably about $100 a year for your average propane tank. And that's another question usually asked is, do they want to assume the oil tank? Because it could be from Irving or one of many other suppliers here on the island. If they don't want to assume the propane tank, it can just be removed and the propane company usually give you back the money for whatever propane is in that tank.
Yeah, and be aware if you're a buyer, don't assume you have time to set up your lease agreement or, yeah, I'll get to that and get busy with other items, because the propane company will send out, or usually at closing, you'll see a pamphlet or a letter to the homeowner because the seller would have notified them. And if you did not start a new lease agreement, I've seen as much as a week after closing, the propane tank has been removed from the property. So stay on top of this prior to closing. Get your lease agreements, get everything all in order.
Next topic. How many times have you presented an offer? The agent looked at the offer price and the closing date and said, yeah, this is pretty good. We're going to get this accepted.
That happens all the time.
And then they come back with their tail between their legs and say, well, I was in a rush and I didn't actually read the terms of the agreement. What's more important, terms or price?
And that's a really good question. And when you did ask me that a couple days ago, Michael, I sat and I paused and thought about it for a moment, but they're both equally important. And that's what I said to you.
The terms are almost more important than the price. And I'll give you an example. We're selling a business, and that business, they want $650 million for. It's a hotel chain. Or it's one big hotel in Vegas.
Okay.
So we're selling this hotel. It's on for $650 million. I write an offer for $1 billion. You as a vendor love it. Oh, it's $1 billion. I was only asking for $650 million. So you haphazardly sign the deal. You'd never do this, but you do. Only to find out the terms of the agreement is that you're going to hold the mortgage for the $1 billion and my payments are $10 a day.
Yeah, that's why you have to read the contracts. That's why they always say, read the fine print. We're in an era and time where people are so used to, when they download apps on their phone or software programs, they just scroll quickly through the whole thing and click, I agree at the bottom. This is not a time to do that.
I had one deal I worked on and the vendor was a builder. So builders are typically well-versed with contractual agreements and reading contracts, specifically real estate contracts. And I was dealing with an agent that had some experience and they didn't read the terms of the agreement. They ended up signing off on it. And later on, it turned into a comedy fest because the agent accused us of using a super small font. We hid the paragraph. I went back into our form software and there was no way you could even change the size of the font, but this was his claim to the owner, so we didn't look like an idiot that, oh, they hid the clause. It was in a 0.001 font at the bottom.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what the font is. And I think I remember that case. I also had a situation in my early years in real estate where the buyer's agent did not, or the seller's agent did not read the offer in its entirety to his seller clients, had them sign it. And a couple of days later, when him and I were on the phone together, I thanked him. I said, could you please thank your clients for agreeing to pay for my client's legal fees? And you wouldn't believe the panic in his voice. And he said, no, they didn't. And I said, yeah, they did. I'm pretty sure you didn't strike that out in our contract. And sure enough, he said he accused me of not pointing that out, whereas it was in black and white on this contract. There was a whole other situation that arose where I ended up having to pay for a portion of those fees.
You should have paid for all of them because that's what was in the contract.
Not for me to do, though.
The good thing about Prince Edward Island and most of Canada is we're all using a standard set of forms in that province or in that within that association. Unlike the states, where they typically can have contracts that are edited and modified right down to the agent level and the broker level. So when you get a contract and you're in Arizona, and I've seen these contracts, it could be 400-500 paragraphs without exaggeration. In PEI, we're all using a pretty standard set of forms. Most of the agents think you can't vary from that. You can. You can write your own schedule. You can write your own purchase and sale if you want. Just may not be protected under Arizona emissions insurance, but you can still do it or have a lawyer write the offer. So one of the things you could do proactively as a buyer or a seller is ask for the template for the purchase and sale agreement and the Schedule A, which would usually be attached to it. Is that good advice?
Yeah.
Or great advice?
No, I think it's very good advice.
Not great?
Sure, Michael.
Tourism numbers. Everybody wants to come to PEI. Can you just give us a quick 30-second abridged version of this? And this document, incidentally, comes from the Prince Edward Island government newsletter, which if you're not on already, you should sign up for it. Just go to gov.pe.ca. It is absolutely wonderful. It tells you everything that's going on in the province, and this is part of it.
Okay, well, I will try my best to go through this. So in 2024, we had which I didn't realize it was this high, 1.71 million non-resident visitors last year on the island. That's incredible, which was up from 6% from 2023 and 5% from the previous year set in 2019. Their PEI generated an estimated 520.7 million in $1 million in visitor spending during 2024. So that's pretty good for the island. A lot of profit for especially a lot of small businesses in that, which is a 4% increase from 2023. 2024 tourism spending on PEI generated a record-setting $87.9 million in provincial tax revenue, a 4.5% increase over the previous record in 2023 and up 7% increase from 2019. The Confederation Bridge traffic reached a record high in 2024, increasing 5% over 2023 and 11% in 2019. The Charlottetown Airport, well, this just has everything, recorded its highest ever air traffic in 2024, up 2% over 2023 and 7% over 2019. That's incredible. And then the ferry. Can I do the ferry?
Nope, that's enough.
No, the traffic for the ferry in 2024 increased 4% over 2023 and was down 24%. Okay, so things are starting to bounce back, but 2024 last year was a really good year for tourism on Prince Edward Island.
It was, and one of the interesting things about the bridge is, if you're ever looking for a nice background for your TV or your computer, you can watch the bridge cam 24 hours a day and see those visitors arriving by bridge.
Yes, I actually watched my son went over to Moncton with a group of friends and that. And he was messaging me, and I have a little tracker on him, which he's in agreement to, just so no one thinks I'm creepy. And I had seen him coming on the bridge, so I went onto the webcam for the Confederation Bridge, and I actually watched him cross over the bridge, which was pretty cool. It does work. It's real time.
On to other things. Water tests. If you're listing your house, when should those be done?
They should be done as soon as you decide to list. Now, that is one of the things that I don't know what your practice is, Michael.
Get them done right away.
Yes, but I do need to let the sellers know that most lenders, so it's not the buyer requesting the water test. It is the lenders. If this buyer is getting financing, your buyer. And if the lender says that they will only accept water tests up to 90 days, that's why I always caution. If it's a season thing, I push it to later in the fall. If we don't have a contract over the winter, I want that water test done prior to. However, if it is a property that is going to sell quickly, or I at least feel there's a vast market for it, I'll get it done immediately.
If they're worried about $200 or $300 to do a bunch of water tests prematurely that they may have to redo because it takes them a year or two to sell the house, just add $200 or $300 to your counteroffer to recoup the costs. The reason I asked to do it right away is that house or property may sell right away, and I want those certificates done. Because if they have a bad test, now they have to repeat them twice. So now you could potentially be in a week, a month and a half, or weeks, depending on the time of the year. Obviously, this time of the year, the water tests, I don't know if you've noticed, but they're turning them around lightning fast, probably because you're the only one getting the water test done. But in the summer, they can be really backed up until a point where we've actually had to have companies off island do the water test, particularly during COVID. But get them done. That's part of your due diligence as a seller, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and if you wait until you have a contract agreement in place to do your water testing, and you do need bacteria and chemical, if you wait until then, now it is logged that there was an issue and you need two clear water
tests. Now your purchaser is going to be spooked and they're going to say, there's problems with the water? We don't want that house. So you're taking all those chances where through my system, if there's anything detected, it can be resolved. If you need to install a UV light or a bacteria filter or whatever, water softener, you can do that. But you can't do it if it's 10 days before closing.
Yeah. And a really good question, if you're a buyer and you're looking at a property and it has a UV light, I usually advise my buyer or let them know, I'm going to, just so you're aware, I'm going to ask this on your behalf, whether this was a proactive installation or reactive, because I think you'll want to know if you have a high bacteria count for and with your water. I think that buyer should be made aware of that, because you can't lapse at all with your UV light, having that light changed every year, because you could potentially put yourself at risk for illness.
And those UV lights have to be replaced because they don't last forever.
Yes.
So check on them every few months to make sure they're still running, or even more than that. If I'm writing a lowball offer, should I have a ton of contingencies on top of that as well, or conditions to make the offer even dirtier, as they say?
Probably not a good idea.
So if I'm coming with a lowball offer and I'm being coached by my agent, what should I be doing to make it more attractive? Let's ask you this. Do you like these letters people send? You know, they attach a letter, says, oh, we're moving in from Botswana and my family just immigrated to Canada and we've saved for 67 years to buy this house and it's the only house we've ever seen and we've been searching for 5 years and we really, really want it. But here's a crappy offer with a bunch of conditions.
It humanizes, though, the buyers, instead of it just being a piece of paper with numbers and terms, to this is who is looking or wanting to buy my house and why they want it and who they are. I think it definitely helps. Now, I know that's not everybody in our industry does not agree along with me. There's many that do and there's many that do not.
The vendor's opinion that matters. It's not ours.
Correct.
You present it, because I had this happen again last week or the week before, and you just present it. It's up to the vendor whether they're going to put weight on that or not. But what should I be doing as a buyer to make my lowball offer look more attractive? If I enclose a letter, that's up to me. What else can I do?
Top of mind thing for me is to at least have my agent, my buyer's agent, ask a few questions of the listing agent to find out what things would make this move easier for the seller. Leaving furniture, what's their preferred closing? Try to give the seller a few little golden nuggets so that I can get the stuff that I really want.
And if you're comfortable, and I'm not advising this at all, get rid of the home inspection, get rid of the septic inspection, make it a clean offer. Your water test is probably a requirement of your financing. By the way, that's negotiable. I've closed deals particularly on cottages that are under snowbanks, where we just couldn't do water tests. So the purchasers just said to their bank, we're not doing a water test. We're either gonna, you can finance this or somebody else can. And they've waived the water test. But make your offer as compelling as you can. Talk to the owner's agent. See what they want as far as timelines. So you may not be coming up to their price, but at least you're meeting their objectives as far as a timeline and a closing date.
That would be on a case-by-case basis too, though. If it's a high-risk client, I think the bank would just say, fine, go take your business elsewhere. But if you have a good, healthy client with, you know, an attractive down payment even, they may be more inclined to work with you.
And the other thing this runs into is our next topic, which is getting offers on properties that turn into multiple offers where you have a number of people competing to buy the same property, but the purchasers aren't being coached properly as to what they need to do to get that house if they're motivated to do so. So I handled the multiple offer situation and all the offers were really bad.
You were the listing agent.
I was.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, these agents, and I asked these agents, like, what are you doing? Like, you're in a multiple offer situation. Both of you wrote offers. Both of them were rejected. Did you not talk to your client and tell them what they need to do to get this house? The response I got, because they're both new agents from the same firm, is this is what the buyer wanted to do. My question is, did anyone tell the buyer or share with them what they need to do?
Yes, in a multiple offer, you would like to think, and I know you, Michael, so I'm pretty confident the property wasn't overpriced. Did either one of them call you and say, what is the seller looking for?
No.
Okay.
So one offer was handwritten. The purchaser's name sort of scrolled up and down and sideways in handwriting. It wasn't witnessed. The date wasn't filled out in the Schedule A, so that you can just take, toss in the trash can because it's not affixed to anything. It was a freaking mess.
Yeah, not good. Multiple offers. You put your best. Now, they are partially right to say this is what my client wanted to offer. It's just a question of whether or not was that buyer properly informed and educated as to this is what this means. You have to put your best foot forward. I always tell my buyer client when I've been in multiple offers, I would tell my buyer client, you put that number down that you feel, and I do my reverse CMA, so we've done everything that we're supposed to. You put the number down that if you don't get the property at that price, you can still lay your head down on your pillow tonight and have a very restful sleep because you could not have gone up an extra dollar.
If I was buying a property, I would call you if I lost that house.
Okay.
I'll let you cover this point here.
So verbal acceptances. I don't get into verbal acceptances, and I don't know what you're looking at because, and I've had this happen to me, so I hate these situations. I will say at this point in time, if I'm representing the seller, which I typically am, and a buyer's agent's throwing out numbers to me, I just tell them to put it in writing. We need to stick it in writing because Murphy's Law, 5 minutes after I send that text or get off the phone saying my client will accept this number, please update the counter, they're going to get another offer that's going to be better or even an opportunity to use it as leverage to change the price.
Or what happens, and it's happened to me a number of times when I was young and foolish, is you'll present an offer at night, they're, you know, into their ninth beer, and it's like, yeah, everything looks good. We'll sign off on this first thing tomorrow morning after we take three or four Tylenols for our hangover.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a different world the next day.
Yes.
So me being stupid, I would tell the others, yeah, we're just going to sign it tomorrow. And then I got to backtrack and say, no, the vendors have decided to do something else. Anything you agree on or anything that is said in the form of an acknowledgement, and I'll give you an example of this in a second, should be documented. For instance, buyer comes along and asks if there's any hazardous waste stored in the backyard. And you say to them, yes, there's 5 oil tanks and 30 years worth of old used tires that have been buried in the backyard. So the buyer says, oh, that's okay. That's no problem at all. I love old tires and oil waste. This would be a great opportunity for that agent to have an acknowledgement signed says they acknowledge this stuff is happening and they're moving forward regardless of the purchaser's agent or agent's recommendation to tell them, well, removing the oil and the tires, and then both of these things have happened, is going to be your responsibility and it's going to cost you a lot of money. So that's what I mean by acknowledgments, particularly when you get into commercial real estate, when you're selling a shopping mall or something, there can be a lot of things said through this transaction. And then at the end of the day, when they pop up and they're ready to sign off, they'll say, well, nobody told me that. And that's when you pull out your nice, shiny acknowledgement, which I usually print on fluorescent orange paper.
Oh, my goodness.
So no one can say they haven't seen it.
Yes. It is a really good practice to get the acknowledgement, even send off an email saying, sellers disclosing the final items, please confirm that your clients are okay with this so that you have it all documented. Verbal conversations mean nothing in the whole legal world. Things have to be documented. So it is a really good practice. I don't tell the other side that my clients have accepted it and present that to my client until it's done. Like, I wait till everything is signed. I've been burnt too many times. I've had people pull the rug out from under me. And now I'm sitting here scrambling and I look incompetent to my client and I won't do it again.
And after they sign these documents, what you do is you get them to hold it up along with today's newspaper headline and get a picture of them.
You sound like you've been burned really bad, Michael.
I've been down the road.
Okay.
Handwritten offers. Everybody now is used to all these digital signatures, which is great, fast, simple, quick. Don't have to leave my office. But there is an issue. When you do decide to write an offer with a pen, you do need to get those documents witnessed, and you also need to make sure that the dates align. So I got an offer that was handwritten, and I actually showed it to you. After you finished your chuckling, we couldn't read the purchaser's name. We couldn't read the address. It wasn't witnessed. The schedules weren't tied to the purchase and sale agreement. So if you're doing things by hand, know what you're doing and do it properly.
Yes, I always do a 3-check count. So writing the offer would be just writing the offer. But then I would go through it and make sure, did I fill in all the blanks? Because our offers are pretty straightforward. It's like fill in the blanks.
Yeah, we've got the easiest forms in North America that I've ever seen. I've seen them from all over the place.
Yeah, it's like going to elementary school and you have to fill in the missing word. That's what our contracts are. They are very simple, but write it. I always do a 3-check. And then even after my clients sign it, I witness everything when they're finished because I want to be able to go through it. I witness it, then I go through it again and make sure I never missed anything. And sometimes my clients will sit there going, you're going through it again? I went, yes, I need to make sure we never missed anything and that I dated everything and I haven't missed a line or, and they're pleased. They're grateful that they have someone that takes so much pride and care. When you see an offer like the one that you had the other day, it just looked like someone just quickly ran through. They were in a rush. They probably did the contract, in my opinion, at the property and were trying to get out.
I think they did it on their knee while they were driving and smoking a cigarette.
Okay.
And drinking a beer, which they shouldn't be doing. Which leads us into our forms and how they lack, in many ways, is the home inspection clause we talked about last week. And I've said, basically, I believe you only get one inspection and it's done as far as what's in writing. So the home inspection basically reads, this agreement is conditional on the home inspection, singular, being carried out satisfactory to the buyer, and it goes on. But it says you have a home inspection. It doesn't mean you have a home inspection, you have a furnace inspection, electrical, plumbing, a wet inspection for wood-burning appliances. It says a home inspection. So the bottom line is, if you're going to get multiple people inspecting the property, have them in the contract. Also, revisits. How much do you like revisits from purchasers on a scale of 0 to 1?
I do not like revisits.
We don't like revisits. Why?
Because it gives an opportunity for the buyer to start finding reasons why they don't want to move forward with the sale. They will find new deficiencies. They'll bring somebody with them who will end up complaining.
Because of uncle brother.
Yeah, I don't like. And it interrupts, because I just had this week, interrupts my sellers. My sellers are stressed. They've got boxes everywhere. They're assuming everything is all good. The conditions have all been removed. And now the buyer wants to come in and measure things.
So what do you say to that agent that wants to go and do a revisit? A revisit, just for anyone that doesn't know, is a purchaser that wants to go back. And they want to show their family the house they've bought, or they want to do some measurements, or they just want to take another look around. What I say is that wasn't in the contract. You have one visit, and that's the pre-closing inspection for most contracts. If you want revisits, put them in the contract so the owner knows about it. What do you usually say?
Yeah, I tell them I would prefer not. I do ask my seller and allow them to make the choice.
Always.
These particular sellers at first had said yes, and then the day of ended up feeling so much pressure and overwhelmed, and the house did not, in their opinion, show as it did on the showings. And also feeling very self-conscious. So I threw that back out at the agent and I just said, my clients are really just feeling self-conscious. This is their home and there's a privacy issue here where all their stuff is everywhere and they're not really feeling comfortable. So we've deferred it until the final walkthrough now. And everybody's hopefully happy or at least okay with the situation.
But if you do want the revisits or additional inspectors, put it in the contract. Moving along, if you want to, a lot of the financial people say, oh, well, go out and buy a duplex and you rent out half of it and it pays your mortgage. Or have some extra cash sitting around, go out and buy an apartment building and you can just watch the money flow in like the river. If you ever actually go to YouTube or Google and Google problems owning rental units, you will soon discover that if you aren't an actual property manager or don't have the education to be a property manager, you shouldn't be in the property management business. In fact, just within the last little while, we've come across a number of people that somebody told them, oh, just buy this and this, you know, money will just keep floating in through the door and you don't need to worry about anything. There's so many issues for people that own apartments they're unaware of because they don't get the proper education. So if you're going to be a property manager, get the education or hire a proper property manager. Me, I would just hire a property manager.
Yeah, someone that does it all the time. They screen your tenants.
Screening is huge. Tell us about screening. What's the average person that wants to rent an apartment look like? Oh, they're dressed to the nines. They got their cars just washed. They're beautiful people. They just present themselves so well. They've got 9 jobs, lots of income, and then they destroy the house. In one case, a gentleman presented himself that way. They backed over the front lawn, destroyed it. They had 9 months worth of garbage in the shed. They used the wood stove to heat the house. The carpets and everything were destroyed. They smoked. But I wasn't a property manager. I wasn't the one that brought them into the property, but the vendors wanted them. So that's what happens. So be careful when you're renting properties out or just hire a property manager that knows what they're doing.
Yeah, we had one incident where the owner was in was up in the Northwest Territories trying to manage the property from there and the tenants, and we were selling it. And unfortunately, because the tenant, we kind of get in to show this unit for like 6 weeks or so. I don't think it was quite 2 months. And finally, we got told that the tenant had notified the seller, said, yeah, you can go ahead and show the property. And we were all excited. We can finally start showings again, only to find out this tenant 6 weeks ago had moved out and gave her key to homeless people downtown who had moved into the house and had completely destroyed it. This house needed to be gutted back to the studs. So just please be aware. Don't assume you can do this without a property manager, someone who's doing regular visits, especially if you do not live on PEI, because this house, it was so sad to see the condition. And I mean, homeless people aren't homeless because they're highly educated professors and that. Unfortunately, these guys didn't know even how to turn up the thermostat for the heat. So they heated the house with the oven door open and they wrote all over the walls and they didn't necessarily use the washroom where the toilet was. And
would this be a typical property you list?
No, the house was really cute up until this happened. So again, worst case scenarios, I've seen a few of them out there. Please do not underestimate the value of a property manager. Okay, Well, we'd like to thank you for tuning in and listening to another episode of the Michael and Patty Show, otherwise known as MAPS, navigating and guiding you through the buying and selling real estate on Prince Edward Island, as well as everything about PEI that we end up just going off on rabbit trails, perhaps sometimes, and including in our conversations and discussions. We appreciate every one of you and hope that you come back next time and listen to our next exciting episode.
If anything, real estate is never-ending constant comedy.
Content, we will call it.
Comedy and entertainment. Everybody, thanks for listening. Be sure to give the podcast a star rating and some feedback and have yourself a fun-filled day.
Have a great day.